What I'm going to talk about is joint work with Matt Rogers and Chris Smith, although not necessarily all together. I'm going to start with a very simple question, a very natural question, which is, when does a polynomial in complex coefficients has all the roots on the unit circle? And the question has been answered. So sufficient and necessary conditions were given by Kohn in 1922. And the result is that a polynomial, complex coefficients, has all the roots on the unit circle if and only if it is self-inversive and the derivative has all the roots in or on the unit circle. Okay? So self-inversive is basically the complex version of being reciprocal. So what it means is probably the best description is what is given by this equation, namely that there is, you know, you can read it forward or backwards, but when you read it backwards, you have to conjugate the coefficients, and also there might be a constant there of this constant epsilon. In fact, it's easy to see that it has to have alpha value 1. So to think about the linear case, for example, with the reciprocal polynomial or anti-reciprocal polynomial would be x minus 1, x plus 1. But here, for me, x minus anything of alpha value 1 also should be considered as a self-reciprocal polynomial. So that's the difference. Okay. So actually, it's not so hard to see that really one needs to have self-inversive here. Now, this theorem is really nice, but depending on where we want to apply it, sometimes it's not so easy to apply. For example, if we have a family of polynomials, then it might be hard to check, you know, infinitely many. You know, we start with infinitely many polynomials, and we have to check infinitely many of these derivatives to see if the roots are inside or on the unit circle. So it might be, in practice, may not be so useful. So for us, the motivation is actually we do want to study a family of polynomials. And this family of polynomials that we want to study, I will define it later. First, I want to focus on a formula by Ramanujan. This is a formula that basically you can see that it has more or less three components, or well, it's actually four, but there are three kinds of terms here. So on one hand, we have a polynomial with Bernoulli coefficients and some binomial coefficients. Then we have a term, then we have a term that has the odd value of the Riemann zeta function, and then we have two infinite sums. Now, if you look closely at the terms with the infinite sums, these are basically these generating series for the Bernoulli numbers. So actually, you can think that everything in this formula that is not the terms with the odd value of the zeta function are actually sums of Bernoulli numbers. And so this formula, in fact, you can think of it as the odd version of Euler's formula for zeta of 2k. Okay, so basically, zeta of 2k minus 1 can be expressed in terms of Bernoulli numbers. Maybe infinitely many ones, but okay. Now, we are going to focus first on the polynomial component of this formula, okay? And those are going to be called Ramanujan polynomials. So basically, just that. And in a very recent paper by Ramamurthy, Chris Smith, and Rob Wang, they studied these polynomials, and they studied the roots of these polynomials. And what they found is that there are four real roots, and then the rest of the roots are all on the unit circle, okay? And the only roots, and they also study which ones of those roots of the unit circle are actually roots of unity. And so they consider these, and then, well, they prove that essentially the only roots of unity showing up are plus or minus one or the six roots of unity. And why do they study this? Well, their motivation comes from another paper, I think it's also from 2010, by Gunn, Ramarty, and Rath, where they actually look at a proof for this Ramanujan formula that was made by Grosswald, where basically, so here's the Ramanujan formula that I showed you before, but now the terms with the infinite sums have actually became some Euler integral, okay? So the integral of some Einstein series. And the idea of, so the idea that they have in this paper, Murthy and Roth, they want to look at this formula and see, okay, so if I have a zero here, okay, then I will have my all theta value expressed in terms of an Euler integral, and then we can study, they can study the properties, the algebraic properties of the Euler integral, and maybe, you know, there is a hope to prove something about the, some information about the algebraic nature of theta of 2k minus 1. So that's their motivation. And they, in fact, prove things, they prove that pretty much most of the time, the thing that should be transcendent is transcendent. Okay. So the term, I mean, this term divided by this term is transcendent most of the time. And then there are issues with roots of unity. So they have an interest in seeing when the roots of this polynomial are roots of unity. And so that's the motivation behind the theorem that I gave you before. Okay. Now, we're proposing something much more elementary. So we go back to Ramanujan formula, okay? So basically, what they did, like I said, is setting this term to zero, and then comparing the special value of the theta function with this term. How about we do the opposite? So how about we set this to zero, and we have then the all theta value in terms of some polynomial. Okay, so in other words, what we had to do is set this side of the equation to zero and see what we get. So when we do that, what we notice, or actually I should be fair to this, Matt Rogers noticed that he always got the zeros of this polynomial were always on the unit circle. Okay, so he came with this question. So, do this family of polynomials have all the roots on the unit circle? And that's how it connects with the beginning of the talk. So, in fact, eventually we were able to prove that yes, so this polynomial has all the roots on the unit circle. And then some related families also have all the roots on the unit circle. And so these are basically Cook from the P, original P, okay? But then also some similar polynomial with Euler numbers have all the roots on the unit circle. I'm writing non-trivial roots here because some of these are actually multiples of some power of z. So basically, the non-zero roots are on the unit circle.
Yes, that was
the point. Yes, thank you. Yes. Okay, so before I go on, these two polynomials, well, they also have expressions in terms of Bernoulli coefficients, and they actually, they all can be fit into similar equations as the one I presented at the beginning, Ramanujan's formula. The S polynomial also has a similar expression too. Okay, so that's how, you know, it was natural to look at all of them. And as a matter of fact, for a long time, we only had proofs for Q, W, and S. So, and you'll see why in a minute. So, well, that was one motivation was, well, why do we look at Q and W? Because we can look at them. But actually, the easiest polynomial to look at is actually S. And to study S, so that was the first thing we studied, we used some other theorems, not Kohn's theorem, but actually other theorems that give sufficient conditions for a polynomial to have the roots on the unit circle. Okay? And these are, there's a family of results by Lakatos, Lozansky, and Schinzel that were published in different papers between 2002 and 2009. That basically, okay, so here's one version of them. If aj are the coefficients of my polynomial, and I have certain inequality between the coefficients, then all the zeros are on the unit circle. So that was, that's a very simple criterion, but of course it's not a necessary condition, right? So we don't necessarily have it always, but that was the first criterion where we tried to use, and with S it works. So the proof is actually very fun. Yes? Reciprocal. Okay, reciprocal here means that the coefficients are real. Okay, so the polynomial has actually real coefficients, and I'm taking reciprocal in the original definition of reciprocal palindromic. Self-inversive, but without conjugating an epsilon. Plus or minus one. Okay. Yes, thank you. Yes. Yes. Thanks. Yeah. So in our case, all the polynomials have, yeah, real coefficients. But, okay. Exactly. Exactly. The thing is that this is a much stronger condition. And so proving that, I just mentioned that it's kind of fun. I mean, it consists of playing with the inequalities of Euler numbers and the binomial convolution of Euler numbers. Now for this criterion that I showed you actually doesn't really answer the question for W and Q, and well, it doesn't answer the question for P either. And so for that, we started looking actually a little bit closer at what this criterion says. Okay, so this was a condition from the results of Lakatos, Lozansky, and Schinzel. And then, okay, so where this is coming from? Actually, if we have this condition, this implies that the polynomial is actually very close, in a sense, to certain function. Okay, and this idea actually was kind of taken from the paper of Ramurti, Chris Smith, and Rob Wang. So they use this idea to prove the results for R, actually, for the original polynomial. So what does this mean? Okay, so we are very close to this function. And basically what it means is if I go to polar coordinates, okay, so I'm only looking, restricting myself to evaluating the function in roots of unit, I'm sorry, on the unit circle, okay, on elements of alpha value 1, then basically what we're getting is that the f is very close to this, closer than 1, but this function of, has high positive and high negative, so alternates between positive and negative values with alpha value greater than 1. So here's a schematic proof of the idea, although for this particular case the drawing should be more symmetric, okay, but I wanted to do like a most general thing, and obviously it's not to scale, so but the idea is that the black line will be you know this function, And basically what we are proving is that the polynomial lies somehow in the red area, okay, close enough to the black function, and so that forces things to oscillate around the circle. And this circle actually is not the unit circle, it's just separating negative values from positive values. So it's a little bit confusing, but basically it's intermediate value. I mean, it's very elementary when you think about it. Okay, so basically alternating positive and negative values with high alpha value. Okay, so that's in a sense a proof of Lakatos, Losansky, and Schinzel, but then we can replace my test function by something else. And so that was the idea. So for the proof of for W, we compare the function, so the polynomial, with this other polynomial, with this function. And where is this coming from? Well, the first terms are really approximating the first, the coefficient of the second highest degree coefficient and the third highest degree coefficient. And then after a long work with many estimates, one can prove that actually the polynomial is very close to this test function by 0.3. And then the other thing one has to do is to prove that the test function alternates with enough absolute value, positive and negative, enough number of times. And that was quite tricky to see, but the idea is to write the test function as two terms. So one has cosine of k minus 1 theta, and the other has sine of k minus 1 theta. So we evaluate, we evaluate in the points where one of the terms is zero, and the other alternates. And so sometimes we make zero the first term, sometimes we make zero the second term, and so, but eventually we do obtain enough points that have that yield absolute value large enough and alternating sign, and so that guarantees that we have essentially we must have two case zeros on the unit circle. So the method works with Q as well, but it doesn't really work with P. Okay, so P for a long time we try. And we couldn't find anything. And then actually Christmas came into the picture. And so here's a proposition. So basically now the idea is to find a similar criterion to Kohn's result. So the result I gave you at the beginning with the derivatives. So we call it a generalization. Okay, I explain why is generalization in quotation marks in a minute. So basically the result says that if I cook, basically understanding what's the structure of these polynomials that have the roots on the unit circle. So if I cook a self-inversive polynomial, so what's the natural way to do it? Well, you pick a polynomial, you reverse the coefficients, conjugate and maybe multiply by some element of some complex number of absolute value 1, and you put them one next to each other, and that's how you build a self-inversive polynomial, for example. So if the statement says that if your initial polynomial has all the roots inside or on the unit circle, then the polynomial that you cook after doing this procedure has all the roots on the unit circle. So that's basically what the statement says. I mean, it's written in a precise way, but that's basically what the statement says. But moreover, if I start with a polynomial that already has the roots on the unit circle, I can always, build it in this way. So I can always find an H that has all the roots in or on the unit circle by taking essentially the derivative of a polynomial. So in that sense, we said that this theorem is a generalization of Kohn results, because in principle, given a polynomial that is not necessarily written with the derivative, it's just written with any h, I can immediately identify that it has to have all the roots on the unit circle. So that's in that sense, it's a generalization. I mean, obviously, it's an if and only if, so it's not really a generalization, but it helps to identify things. So as a corollary, one can prove actually some natural condition in terms of coefficients, similar to the one I gave you from Lakatos, Dosansky, and Schinzel, except that the one I gave you was comparing, was making the difference between the coefficients and the main coefficient. Here we make a difference between consecutive coefficients, okay? And in fact, by the triangular inequality, it's not hard to see that this implies the other one, okay? But again, it's a nice criterion that again is sufficient, not necessary. The way it's proved, I didn't mention that the previous theorem, the way it's proved is by clever applications of Fourier's theorem. Here, this is proved by considering the polynomial multiplied by the linear z minus 1. Now, for the proof of P, actually, what we had to do is also prove that if we perturbate by a small enough polynomial, so remember that the result I gave you is H plus H star, in a sense, or reverse H. Now, I'm going to perturbate H with some small polynomial. And small in what sense? Well, smaller than H on the unit circle. So if H has an absolute value, has a lower bound on the unit circle, then if I take another polynomial such that it has, is in absolute value, is small, smaller than H on the unit circle, then I do the same construction that I had before. Okay, so cooking up my self-inversive polynomial out of H, but now I add E into the picture, then I still have all the zeros on the unit circle. And again, for this is, again, some clever application of Fourier's theorem. And then, okay, so then what we did, so the actual proof with P consists of actually writing P, well, not exactly P, P multiplied by z squared plus 1. This has to do because the coefficients of P are kind of large, but they are alternating and close to each other, so when we multiply things, they get smaller, okay? And then we write this as a sum of, well, H and E, okay? So basically, what we do is we're taking 8 coefficients in the head and 8 coefficients in the tail, and that we're looking at that polynomial. So that will be my H, and then everything in the middle is going to be my error, my E. Okay, and this after many estimates, one can prove that actually the error in the middle is always is smaller than some constant, 0.019, and then the polynomial that is made from the head is actually bigger, so we can apply the lemma eventually. Okay. And, so this hides a lot of computations in the middle. So basically, before, just let me finish this by saying that this method also can be applied to the other polynomials I'll show you, especially the W and Q that were complicated. So that basically ends what we've done. Obviously, there are many questions to explore. So one is, what are the consequences of this criterion that I give you? So this sort of generalization of Kahn's result. To maybe to other families of polynomials, and then the other one is, well, the sort of motivation of why we're looking at these Ramanujan polynomials. Okay, can this be used to say something about the actual nature of the values of set of 2k minus 1? And so that's all. Thank you very much.